Today, is John Bolton leading Donald Trump towards a war with Iran? And Guardian Editor-in-Chief Catherine Viner on the way we talk about a climate emergency. This is a story about Donald Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton and fears of a war between the US and Iran. But we begin more than 10 years ago with Guardian columnist George Monbiot in Wales.
I was sitting on a panel at the Hay Literary Festival in 2008, and I remarked that the greatest crime of the 21st century, the Iraq War, had been so normalised that one of the authors of that crime, John Bolton, was there at the festival promoting his memoirs. But that if we really were serious about the principles we claim to espouse, someone should go and arrest him.
The question, though, was who?
Well, of course, after the panel that I was on, I thought to myself, wait a minute, I've been calling for other people to do this thing that I'm not prepared to do myself. So at that point, I said to myself, I have to arrest John Bolton. And so I sat down to make sure that I had my case lined up. And you've got to picture this situation in this beautiful place in the east part of Wales, the Wye Valley, with all these tents flapping away and all these literary types going around there kissing each other. And there I was pouring through my sort of informal indictment.
George took his evidence and went off in search of John Bolton himself.
And so I got my place in the big tent and waited for my moment. And then I came down and started to step up onto the stage. I just started saying, John Bolton, and I had this weird flying sensation. It was like being Peter Pan. I was suddenly swinging through the air. And I'd literally been tucked under the arm of one of the biggest people I've ever seen in my life. This guy must have been 7 foot tall and about the same across. He was just unbelievable in his man mountain. And he had me under one arm and just walked out of the stage door with me under his arm. Literally my arms and legs flapping in the air as I tried to get some purchase or something.
And did this giant of a man, where did he plop you down?
He just dumped me unceremoniously behind some toilets and then walked away.
A decade later, John Bolton is at the heart of Donald Trump's White House. And it was at his prompting that this month the Trump administration sent an aircraft carrier and B-52 bombers into the Persian Gulf, ordered US personnel to leave nearby Iraq, and updated its war plans for a potential conflict with Iran. On Sunday, Trump warned on Twitter that if Iran wants to fight, that will be the official end of Iran. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, who is John Bolton and is he trying to start a war with Iran? Tell me about John Bolton's background.
He was very much involved in the Bush administration's drive to go to war in Iraq, was involved in the collection and processing of intelligence about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction that turned out to be entirely bogus.
Julian Borger is The Guardian's World Affairs editor.
So very much the ultra hawk from the Bush days, very much associated with the invasion of Iraq.
So the invasion of Iraq was in 2003. In 2008, Barack Obama is elected president and the Republicans are no longer in power. What does John Bolton do at this point?
Well, he goes back to the American Enterprise Institute, which is a sort of hawk central in terms of foreign policy in Washington as one of these think tanks. But he also spends an awful lot of time as a regular contributor on Fox News.
Weapons program, and the problem the United States faces is that for more than 15 years, we have followed an obviously failed policy, that policy being trying to see if we could negotiate North Korea.
There was a time during the Obama administration when it was almost impossible to turn on TV and avoid him. You would see this man in his late 60s with his bristling gray mustache, kind of walrus mustache, quaking with fury and derision at the Obama administration and the whole idea of multilateral diplomacy, something that he saw as a liberal pipe dream.
So during all this time, Obama is working to that deal. Under the agreement, Iran said it would limit nuclear activities and allow inspectors in, and in return, crippling economic sanctions would be lifted. The deal is finally signed in 2015.
Today, after 2 years of negotiations, the United States, together with our international partners, has achieved something that decades of animosity has not: a comprehensive, long-term deal with Iran that will prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
People came out on the streets in the immediate aftermath, filling the streets in Tehran, beeping their horns, waving flags. There was this instant sense of relief and hope that the long years of isolation might be coming to an end and that Iran might be reintegrated into the rest of the international community and no longer be treated as a pariah.
In the first months and years, did it appear to be working?
Iran did everything that was expected of it under the deal in terms of dialing down its enrichment. So there was this bitterness, you know, on the part of the Iranian government that they were doing everything that was required. And yet when it came to the promised Western investment, it hadn't materialized. And there was this feeling that the US government in particular wasn't doing enough to encourage US firms, companies, corporations to invest. There wasn't enough proactive push from Washington.
So during this time, Donald Trump is chosen as the Republican candidate. And it sounds from what you're saying that Iran may not be benefiting as much as expected from the deal, but it is doing what the Western countries wanted it to do. But he doesn't like the deal, does he? And is he talking about that in his election campaign?
Very much so. He, one of the main points of his foreign policy and election campaign was that it was the worst deal ever made by the US.
I've been doing deals for a long time. I've been making lots of wonderful deals, great deals. That's what I do. Never, ever, ever in my life have I seen any transaction so incompetently negotiated as our deal with Iran. And I mean never.
It was a horrible deal, and one of the first things he would do would take the US out of it. And that's what he wanted to do, and was persuaded for the first year in office not to do that by his State Department and National Security Advisor. And so his hand was stayed, but he very much associated it as being an Obama deal. And one of the defining features, especially of his first year in office, was to try and undo all of Obama's signature achievements.
Do we know when Trump's running for president, whether he is aware of John Bolton? Does he know him? Does he listen to him? Does he like him?
John Bolton was a visitor to Trump Tower and auditioned for various jobs. The job he really wanted was Secretary of State. His dream was to become Secretary of State. But he lost that competition mainly because some of the elders from the Bush era really pushed the case of Rex Tillerson, the oil baron from Texas. And so the other score against Bolton is that Trump took objection to his moustache. He really didn't think that Bolton looked the part.
What was wrong with the moustache?
He didn't think it made him look like a Secretary of State. And if you look at those early appointments, especially in foreign policy and in national security, that Trump made, you know, he wanted people to look the part. And so James Mattis looked like this tough Marine and he really liked this.
And could he have asked John Bolton to shave his moustache?
We don't know if that request was ever made, but it was reported that he had commented to others that he was impressed by Bolton, but really didn't like the big moustache.
But Bolton keeps pushing and Trump hasn't ruled him out.
There was one thing about Bolton that Trump really admired. He really enraged the liberals and the Obamaites, and the fact that he was such a red flag really drew him to Trump. In terms of re-election, the Trump strategy is to fire up the base. And one thing you can say about John Bolton is that he polarizes, and that means he does fire up the conservative red state America base.
But Donald Trump loses two national security advisors. Michael Flynn goes, H.R. McMaster goes, and then in April 2018, Bolton gets the job. And a month later, the US pulls out of the Iran deal.
The Iran deal is defective at its core. Therefore, I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
Is the timing significant?
Absolutely. He was an opponent of the deal from the very get-go.
Is Iran a good deal? Is it a bad deal? Does it help us with national security? Does it hurt it?
No, it's a grave threat to American national security. This basically...
He was an advocate of going to war with Iran to get rid of its nuclear program, not to make a deal with Iran.
And what does it mean when they pull out?
It means that the US immediately threatens to reimpose sanctions and then gradually steps up those sanctions and threatens to take measures against European other foreign companies that continue to do business until finally earlier this month it took out the last waivers that allowed countries like China, Turkey and India to carry on buying Iran oil with the aim of imposing a complete oil embargo.
Today, I'm announcing that we will no longer grant any exemptions. We're going to zero across the board. We will continue to enforce sanctions and monitor compliance. Any nation or entity interacting with Iran should do its diligence and err on the side of caution.
So from that moment, the screw on Iran began to be tightened again.
If this is making the world a safer place, if it's making a country that people are worried about less likely to produce nuclear weapons, Trump can't just say it's because it was Obama's. I mean, did he have specific problems with the deal that he was able to articulate?
The conservative critique of the deal was, number one, that some elements of it had timelines. And so after a certain amount of time, Iran would be able to do greater amount of research and development on centrifuges. That was one element, that it had sunset clauses. Number two, it only dealt with the nuclear issue. It didn't deal with missiles and it didn't deal with Iran's activities elsewhere in the region, in Syria, in Yemen. And so the critique of conservatives in Washington is by allowing Iran to earn money off its oil and its trade, it's spending that money by funding its proxies in Yemen, Syria and Iraq.
So in the US, we're starting to hear more and more anti-Iran rhetoric. And earlier this month, we learned that the American military had written a new war plan for a potential conflict in Iran. What do those plans look like?
Well, at the top end, we're told that there's a plan, an option for 120,000 US troops to be sent to the region in case of Iranian military action.
A new military move to challenge Iran, sending more forces to the Middle East in response to potential threats against American troops in the region. The Trump administration announced yesterday that a US aircraft carrier and a bomber task force are being sent to areas closer to Iran.
Already a aircraft carrier strike group has arrived in the region, and they've sent a bomber wing of B-52 bombers to Qatar. So there is a noticeable military build-up.
Is this arm flexing?
Certainly it is being presented as much, especially by John Bolton.
President Trump's national security advisor John Bolton says it sends, quote, a clear and unmistakable message to the Iranian regime.
John Bolton demanded that the Pentagon came up with more expansive military options than had been on the table before. And he was the one who demanded to be able to showcase the deployment of the Lingan aircraft carrier and the bomber arm to the Gulf as being a response to a perceived Iranian threat.
What sort of intelligence are the US officials citing?
There are various reports of missiles being put on dhows and a general chatter about the prospect or plans to attack US diplomatic and military facilities in Iraq. This is what's come out through the US press. But again, you know, there's been no presentation by the administration. It's been something briefed on background to various reporters. So all a little bit reminiscent, of course, of the build-up to the Iraq war.
Which, of course, involved John Bolton, who was accused of exaggerating or even lying about intelligence.
That's right. I mean, in a way, you know, we've seen this movie before. Difference is that Bolton liked the first movie. He was completely unrepentant about the Iraq war. And, you know, and clearly is making some of the same plays as we saw in the build-up to that invasion to come up with justifications for going to war with Iran.
So what do Iranian officials make of all this?
Well, the Iranian officials see this as a play by the US hawks. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif was in New York a few weeks ago saying he was sure that Trump didn't want a war, and it's Bolton and Mohammed bin Salman and Benjamin Netanyahu, the people he called the B-team, that were trying to create this war and push Trump. And he went on to Fox News to try and get his message over directly to Trump that you are being bamboozled into a war that you really don't want.
Foreign Minister Zarif, welcome to Fox News Sunday.
Good to be with you.
You say that there is a small group of American and Mideast officials who are trying to steer President Trump into a conflict with Iran. Who and why?
Well, I base my statement on their own statements.
Because he knows that Trump is likely to be sitting in the White House watching Fox News.
Yeah, everyone is in Washington and around the world know that if you want to get through to Trump directly, you want to get on Fox News, preferably on Fox and Friends in the morning. And the chances are that he will, you know, see you and you'll be the last person to influence him before he goes into a meeting.
Wow, that's quite scary. Does President Trump want to go to war?
Everyone who's talked to him in private says no, he doesn't. This was one of his campaign promises to take the US out of wars. He sees them as being unbearably costly and unnecessary for the US to be involved around the world.
And I'm not one that believes, you know, I'm not somebody that wants to go into war. Because war hurts economies, war kills people, most importantly, by far, most importantly.
And he, on occasion, has pointed to John Bolton when he's had foreign visitors and said, this guy over here, he wants me to go to a war, but I'm going to keep him in check. And a couple of days ago, told reporters that he knows that Bolton has a fierce temperament and it's him, President Trump, that is tempering Bolton, so showing his awareness. He wanted to rip up the nuclear deal because it was Obama, and this belief, this self-belief that he could get a better deal that would be his deal and would be the best deal ever. And his model for doing deals is to put a lot of pressure on the other side until the top guy on the other side reaches out to Trump in person, and then they sit down and they emerge with this wonderful deal, whatever the terms are. You know, because it is Trump, it will be wonderful, and that's what we saw with Kim Jong-un in the two summits they had. Nothing was promised, nothing was achieved, but it was Trump's deal, and it came out, and he presented it as peace in our time. Now, this he's hinted is what he wants to happen with Iran. He said to the Iranian leadership, you know, just call me.
Will that happen?
That's very unlikely to happen. It happened with Kim Jong-un because Kim Jong-un was ready to talk. He made his nuclear arsenal, and he was interested in sanctions relief, and he had total control. Iran is a very different picture.
Is there a risk that this turns into provocation that could actually start a war?
The Persian Gulf is a narrow waterway, especially the Strait of Hormuz, and there's a lot of traffic going through, some of it military. There is the US fleet there, and there is a lot of Iranian naval activity as well, and Revolutionary Guard naval activity. But it's quite possible that something could happen, that one of these boats would have a go at a US ship and the whole thing kick off. We've already seen there have been attacks on four tankers, oil tankers, off the coast of the UAE. It's not known who was responsible, but there was these sabotage attacks. And then there were drone attacks on Saudi oil installations, which have been claimed by the Houthi rebels, but the Houthi rebels are connected to Iran. So you can see overall it is a tinderbox and a high-risk environment.
And just finally, how much does John Bolton want to see a war?
It's clear from everything in John Bolton's past that he sees his approach is one of coercion. You use maximum pressure to advance US interests, and that pressure only works if you are prepared to go to war. And he is very much a believer in the primacy of American military might. So he, I believe, would have no compunction whatsoever in going to war if it meant defeating a challenge to US primacy in the Middle East.
That was George Monbiot and Julian Borger. Do read all their brilliant work at theguardian.com. Coming up, it's time to change the language we use to describe a climate crisis. Now, The Guardian editor-in-chief Catherine Viner on why The Guardian is updating its style guide and changing its language about the global climate emergency.
We felt it was an important and urgent thing to do because the climate emergency is already here. It's already happening. It's no longer a problem of the future. And so we think using more accurate language that also reflects the pressing and urgent nature of the climate emergency was a powerful thing to do. Instead of using the term climate change, we'll generally be using climate emergency, climate crisis, or climate breakdown. Instead of using the term global warming, we'll be using the term global heating, generally replacing biodiversity with wildlife, fish stocks with fish populations. And instead of saying climate skeptic, we'll be saying climate science denier or climate denier. I mean, language matters. The words we use matter, and we endeavour at all times to use terms that actually reflect the phenomena they describe. And we started to feel that the terms we were using, such as climate change, weren't sufficient and weren't properly describing what's really going on. I mean, none of the existing terms are banned, I think, particularly in the case of biodiversity and wildlife, which don't quite exactly mean the same thing. I can understand why occasionally we might use biodiversity instead. But, you know, it's not a well understood term, and it's a bit clinical when what we're talking about is the creatures that share our planet. Last year, the UN's leading scientists warned that there were just 12 years to limit climate catastrophe. And earlier this month, another UN report warned that the widespread collapse of ecosystems was putting humanity itself at risk. Last week, we reported the Antarctic ice is melting much faster than previously feared. In the light of all that, you can see why we wanted to change the language. So the Guardian Style Guide is a sort of living, breathing thing. It's not fixed in stone. It's something we debate over a lot, we argue about, and we're proud to make these changes, though. And I think journalists in the building are really pleased that we've made these changes. I mean, The Guardian has been committed to covering the environment very well for a long time. It's an incredibly important area for us and for our readers. It feels more important than ever to ensure that our readers know all the facts about what is happening and what scientists are discovering and what governments and business and people need to do to face the threat of the climate crisis and the loss of our wildlife. The evidence on the scale and the severity of the climate emergency is growing, and so is public awareness of the threat. So the response has been incredibly positive. Greta Thunberg tweeted, great news. You might expect that. Readers are very excited about it and pointing out when we're slipping up already. So it's really encouraging. I think these changes tell you a lot about who we are, about why The Guardian exists, and about how seriously we take the climate crisis. So this is a professor of climatology who got in touch to say, the language we use to discuss the greatest challenge facing humanity must reflect the urgency and the importance. The Guardian's new editorial guidelines shows a clear understanding that the world has changed and the zeitgeist generated by Extinction Rebellion and the climate school strikes. The Guardian is right that they are climate deniers, it is global heating, and we're in a climate and environmental crisis. Using the correct terms will help everyone understand the challenges we all face, and maybe, just maybe, we can save the planet by the middle of the century.
That was Guardian Editor-in-Chief Catherine Viner. You can read more about those changes on the website. My thanks to her and to George Monbiot and Julian Borgia. I do hope you are enjoying Today in Focus. If you are, then please do subscribe and leave us a review. Today's episode was produced by Mithali Rao and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.